Hello, and welcome to SoberCast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting SoberCast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, my name is Mackenzie. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, Dwayne, good to see you. I like the wave there. That's good. So to start off, my sobriety date is March 16th, 2005. I have a sponsor. I have a sponsee at the moment. Let's see. I'll talk a little bit about when I was younger, but not a whole lot. I guess some of the, what I'll briefly say is that, I grew up in a decent home. I was cared for and provided for, like, you know, never missed meals, the lights weren't turned off, bills weren't paid. It was nothing like that. I grew up in a family where issues weren't really discussed and you kind of figured things out on your own. And like, I grew up in a family where you didn't really talk to each other about problems that were going on. And what I basically observed and watched was the adults in my family, like when there was an issue, you just kind of deal with it on your own and you just suck it up and move on a little bit. So that's kind of what I adopted, and, you know, monkey see, monkey do. That's just kind of how I went through. I also, you know, it kind of depends on who I was staying with. My mom was single growing up, when I was growing up. My father was not in the picture. And so if I was staying with my grandparents, things were usually a pretty solid Warden June Cleaver kind of lifestyle. When I was with my mother, it was a complete opposite. Saw a lot of things that young kids shouldn't see. Experienced a lot of things they probably shouldn't, and that's a pretty blanket statement that I can just kind of leave it at that for my youth when I was little, as far as that goes. Let's see. Growing up, I feel like I always felt like I was one of those kids. I was just not quite good enough than everybody else. I was a small kid, so even though I played a lot of sports and I was an athlete, I was kind of like an average athlete. You know, I was never the best at pretty much anything that I did, but I was okay. Student, about the same. I was kind of like a C student until I got to high school, which had really tanked because I was partying too hard. And I always just kind of had this built, and I got bullied a lot. I got beat up a lot because I was a little kid. And like when you grew up in the 80s, that was like a normal thing. That was still allowed and that was okay. And like, you know, you could get paddled by principals even when I was in school. Like, I can remember being in the fourth grade and being paddled and the heck kicked out of me by a principal. Like, that was okay back then. So I grew up like around violence and like physical abuse. Like, that's just, it was part of my deal. I don't think I had a lot of self-respect for myself because of that. And again, I always just kind of felt like I was a little less than everyone else. Moving along, when I got to my high school years, when my mom and I moved to Cincinnati, I grew up in Ohio, and I had spent my first 16 years in Eastern Ohio, kind of a very rural area. And then when we moved to Cincinnati, I was taken from a Catholic school to a public school, which was a way, way, way different experience than a Catholic school in Eastern Ohio. And, you know, kids my age, when I was a sophomore, like, they were drinking and they were doing drugs. And, like, nobody was doing that when I lived in Eastern Ohio. And I actually did have my first drinking experience in Eastern Ohio. It was right before I left. And I went out and I hung out with, like, a couple of my friends were seniors in the school and I was a sophomore. And they just invited me one time to, like, a senior party. And you know, they were drinking that's where I did that for the first time. And I think I drank maybe a six pack or something like that, but I got really, really hammered. They took my keys from me. You know, I was throwing up, had people take care of me. And I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. I loved the feeling of just that rush, that the very first one, you always chase it, right? And, I loved the feeling. I felt like for the first time, basically ever, that I belonged, and I was like everybody else, and I was kind of on par, and I was cool, and I was popular when I was drinking with these older kids. And they were saying that, you're like, oh, all those kids in the sophomores are lame. You're the only cool one. And they're feeding my head with it. Right. So, I did have that experience. And then when I moved to Cincinnati, everybody around me was doing it. And I just jumped in with both feet by a long shot and just started partying really hard. and became pretty out of control for my mom. Like, she didn't know how to handle me. She didn't know what to do. And, you know, my grades started to slip. I was a wrestler all through high school, and I still was, you know, an athlete, and I would hang with those kids too. But I started becoming known as, like, you know, the partying crew by absolutely, you know, like, it got to the point, like, we were the people that I hung out with. Like, when we would try to show up at parties, we weren't allowed in sometimes because they knew that we were going to destroy things and tear up people's houses and steal alcohol and do what we do. And, I was having the time of my life. I thought it was so much fun. And, you know, I developed a pretty good tolerance quickly. But I wasn't heavily into drinking at that point. That's when I was doing, mostly harder drugs, was when I was in high school. And then I started dealing harder drugs in high school, which I learned after a long, you know, a few years ago, like, that's a felony and that's, you can't actually do that. But when I was a kid, I didn't know that. So thankfully I never got caught. I could have gotten a lot of trouble for that. While all this was going on, even though I was having fun and it seemed like that I belonged in all these situations, I had a lot of sadness was building up, but I also feel like it was just because it was everything that had been built up all my entire life. And for some reason it was all spiraling and, you know, when you're a teenager, hormones, and you're just kind of, you don't really understand life and things are confusing. And, I started growing a lot of depression, and it was building up and building up and building up. And again, I'm not going to go talk to anybody about it. And I would just try to drink or do drugs. And that was fine because, like, those things would go away when I would get to a blackout state, but they'd come back. And, I always hate talking about this next part, but it's part of my story. So I came, I had an incident happen to where that just kind of set me over the edge, and I was super, upset. And, basically just one night, like, with my mom, at home, I, you know, said normal night, I said good night, you know, I'll see you tomorrow. And then she went to bed, and then I made the decision I was going to take my life. And, so I went in, I waited about an hour till after she was asleep, and I started this process and started slicing on my wrist. And I wasn't very good at it. I didn't know how to do it properly. And then I started seeing blood and freaking out. And I ended up calling a friend to come pick me up because I don't know. I was just like, I have to stop this. Like, this is a little much. And, you know, I'm in danger here. So I had somebody come pick me up. They took me to the hospital. They had to call my mom at home, who's sleeping in the next room, you know, and trying to answer this phone call. Like, no, my son's right next, you know, no, you know. She had to come, and, you know, and then, yeah, then I got to go spend a week in a psychiatric ward, which was an extremely eye-opening experience, and it was tough. And, you know, I'm going to pause for just a second on that. I normally don't have a hard time talking about that part, but I think this week with the Chris Cornell thing, like, I've had a really, really difficult time getting through that this week, to be honest with you. And I relied very heavily on this program to help me get through that. And I think that's why it's kind of, this part has hit me hard right now. And yes, so I don't want to talk too much on it because I know I need to stick with, like, you know, my disease and AA and all that. But, it's just an idea of, like, that's where my decision making is when I drink and when I'm doing drugs. Like, I think that that's a good idea to go to do things like that. And that seems like a good choice. So I'll just kind of end it with that. That's where my mindset goes when I'm saturating my brain in chemicals to try to not deal with things. So fast forward a little bit. I got out of that, changed nothing. I partied even harder. I think that's when I graduated high school, which I barely did. That's a story within itself, but I barely did that. And then, so when I did, that's actually pretty much when I stopped doing hard drugs for the most part, was when I got out of high school. And that's where I really started up drinking really, really heavily. And, you know, looking back on it, I think at the time I used to think that it was fun, and I did all kinds of things. Like, we went to, like, Mardi Gras multiple times down in New Orleans and, you know, Vegas and New York and Panama City spring break. And those things seemed fun at the time. But looking back on it, I wasn't really having as much fun as I thought because I was still extremely sad on the inside. And getting to this point in my life is, like, where my blackout drinking really started to kick into overdrive. And I was a blackout drinker, and that was, like, my goal every single time I drank. Like, I wanted to get to the point to where all my problems would go away. And that's the only way that my problems would ever go away is if I could just be blacked out. And yeah, they'd come back the next day, but there was a solution. I could just drink more. And it's not to say that I drank, you know, 365 days a year. Of course, that's not, I didn't do that for all those years, but I knew the solution, so to speak. And if you think about it, like, okay, putting depressants into your body with alcohol to try to get rid of your depressing issues and everything else, like there's, again, it's just kind of where my logic was for things like that. Excuse me. So being a blackout drinker was, being for that to be my goal and to get to that state was not something that I would tell my friends or the people that I would hang out with. There were times we would go out to a bar, and of course we'd usually pregame and have 6-8 beers, whatever. I lived in Ohio. We drank Bud Lights. You can drink like 30 of those things, you know. So we would always pregame heavily. And if we went out to a bar or something like that, when we go home, you know, it's like a normal end of the night. Everybody'd say goodnight. And I would go home. And if I wasn't to the state that I wanted to be in, that blacked out state, I would just keep drinking by myself. And sometimes that was till 3, 5, 8 o'clock in the morning until I got to where I was trying to get to. And then they'd be really confused the next day when it's like 6 p.m. and I can't get out of bed still. And they're like, well, you drank the same amount of us and, you know, you went to bed. It seemed like you're just weak. I'm like, yeah, that's it. I'm just weak. Because I hid everything from them because it was, I didn't want them to think I was an alcoholic because that would be terribly embarrassing. And I'm not going to tell them about any of the problems I got going on because that would be embarrassing as well. And I don't want to throw my problems upon other people. So I had all this just building up inside of me for the most part. And honestly too, like another reason why that I wanted to get to blackout state, I hoped because I still had like these kind of suicidal thoughts. And like, I hoped that when I would drink myself to death and never wake up. For many, many times and many, many years, that was the goal. Hopefully tonight will be it. And I won't have to, and it won't be a gruesome thing, you know what I mean? Like a severe way to take my life. It's like, I just won't wake up. That's what I aimed for. Pretty much most times that I drank. I didn't go to like have like 4 or 5 beers in like the nice sunny day and, you know, enjoy a meal out on a patio. That was not for me. I either would drink, you know, want to drink all the way to the push or not at all. There wasn't really a middle ground or a reason for that. And so again, these are all just things like I didn't share with people and it was pushing. And the blackout stuff got bad, like really, really bad. I drove all the time. Like one of my moves was like my routine was like after a hard night of drinking, I wanted to go get Taco Bell or White Castle or Waffle House or whatever. And I wanted to go home and eat it. And I was going to drive no matter what condition I was in to go and get those things. And it got to the point. So, you know, my friends would start trying to take my keys from me, which would really irritate me because we didn't have Ubers and Lyfts or even cabs back then where I was. So I was an escape artist. Like, I would kind of fake how loaded I was and be like, oh, I got to go get something out of my car. And then I'd bolt or like I would escape out like a bathroom window or something like that. And they'd be so, but we didn't have cell phones back then. So it's not like they could call me or what could they have done anyway? And I would just escape because that's what I wanted to do. And I didn't want them interrupting my plan. And I did that all the time. But unfortunately, I did that a lot in a blacked out state. And, you know, I would wake up in other parts of town. I would wake up, you know, in my car. Sometimes I'd wake up at home with the car, like in the middle of my front yard or like down the street or parked halfway. Sometimes my car wasn't even there and I had to have like my roommates help me go find it. We'd have to go drive around town for an hour to see where was I, you know, because I didn't know. But that sick feeling though, I'll never forget that. Like when you wake up the next morning from something like that of like, what have I done? It was like, I knew like maybe I ran some people over and you know, maybe I killed some people last night. Maybe the police are looking for me right now. And I didn't know, like there's nothing. It's just like hanging out with some friends and then boom, like 5 seconds later, it's morning. It was like a quantum leap type thing, like literally like that. And I did it all the time. And weird thing is I liked it. But I didn't like that sick feeling that it gave me. And I would be very upset with myself and having that sick feeling. And I did like, you know, probably a lot of people I hear in the rooms are like, never again. I'm not, never going to do that again. There's no way, not tonight and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, around noon, get a little bit of food. In the afternoon, the hangover starts going off. Maybe get a greasy burger. Yeah, I'll go have a few. And next thing you know, it's just the cycle just goes and goes and goes, and it never stops. And I was able to – I had a pretty good job back then for the government, and you have to really screw up at a government job to get fired. And I just couldn't get fired for, like, all kinds of things that I did. And I – for a long time, I had a pretty good discipline of, like, no matter how tanked I was, I would still make it into work the next day. And I'd have coworkers trying to, like, cover up for me, like, man, you really need to eat this gum, like, you stink, and blah, 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 and here's some deodorant, whatever. Or don't talk to the supervisor, like, and I would have people cover for me. And I was able to pull that off for a really long time, and I could still make it in, you know, on, like, 5 days a week. And then it started slipping down to, like, well, 4 days a week, you know, I'd have to miss a day here and there. And then it just started, weekdays were really difficult to do it. So I've become a weekend warrior. And I remember for a lot of years, like, I worked 4/10. So I would get off work on a Thursday, and then I've got 3 days to go party. And, especially for a couple of those years, I had a friend who lived in a crack house down in Kentucky. And so I would get off work Thursday and just go straight to his house, and, you know, maybe I'd make it home Sunday night. A lot of times I woke up there Monday morning tanked, and I'd have to go drive to work in the same work clothes from, you know, last Thursday. And rinse and repeat, man. That's just another week. Just go do it. And his place was a lot of fun. Like, he had a lot of drugs and all kinds of stuff. And, like, I can remember, I thought of this, like, the other day, or from Mother's Day, actually. So, like, I can remember one time on a Mother's Day where we went to a Reds game, me, him, and just a bunch of people, and we were partying. And but I had to go hang out with Mom for Mother's Day, but I was wasted. And so I went and I picked her up, and a dead face lied. Have you been drinking? No, my friends were, and, you know, they spilled it on me. It's just, it's on my jeans and blah, blah. And I was hammered. Of course I was wasted. And she knew, you know, and she questioned it, but, I mean, she just didn't give it a fight. I think she was just happy that I was there. And, anyway, my friends, like, even had to talk me into going to the dinner with her, because, like, they had drugs and alcohol and girls. Like, I didn't want to go. I wanted to stay there with them. And, of course, when the meal was over, where do you think I went? I beelined it right back down there. And, yeah, that place was crazy. You know, I'm not going to go in a drunkalog, but a lot of forgettable should-be things happened there. But so anyway, it started getting to the point that, like, even the weekend warrior stuff wasn't working. My body was starting to break down too, like at the age of like 26. A lot of physical problems, nosebleeds. I couldn't sleep at night. The only way I could basically sleep is if I took sleeping pills or I drank. Otherwise, I just couldn't sleep at night. I'd toss and turn the entire night because I just had all this stuff going on in my head. And that's a pretty rough combo there of, like, having to do one of those two things to go to sleep. And everything just started falling apart. Like, I started, even being on a weekend warrior, missing a lot of weekdays and things like that. And, you know, it's a weird feeling, too, like when you wake up sometimes, like in the middle of the day on a Monday, like at 2 p.m., and you wonder, because you were blacked out, you're like, I wonder if I called off work. And what do you do at that point? Do you call in and be like, hey, sorry, I forgot to call this morning? Because if you do that, maybe you already did call off, and now you're calling twice, so it's a real gamble what to do. And I'd have to sit there for an hour and smoke cigarettes, like, damn, what do I do? Usually I just rolled the dice and never called in, and, again, government job. Like, I was always covered for it. But things really just started spiraling out of control. It's starting to get to the point where I couldn't hold relationships with girls because, like, everything just had to be all about me, and I was just a complete I can't cuss this man. I was not a good person in a lot with about a whole lot of things like that. I don't even know how to dance around that. The very deep depression things were starting to come back again, and I was starting to feel like a failure. And I was making good money, and I had material things, and, you know, I really wasn't in debt or nothing like that, but I was miserable again. And I couldn't understand that. And I really just broke down one time. Yeah, I gained a lot of weight, like 40 pounds, and my cholesterol at that age, they told me it was like somebody in their mid-50s or something like that. Like, I was just in really bad shape, and I just lost it. And I just called a friend one time, and I was crying, which was something I never, ever did. I never cried. I went to funerals for friends who died and even took their lives, never cried. I didn't have the ability to do that. And when I started doing that in this program, that was a really, really weird thing for me. The ability to actually cry and shed tears. And it's not that I was trying to be a tough guy. I just couldn't. That emotion would not happen. And so I knew, well, sometimes if I was like on a lot of whiskey, I would cry. But other than that, and so I knew that, like, since I was crying and calling my friend, that there was a real serious problem. And I'm like, man, I'm miserable. I don't think I even want to be alive. And he's like, maybe you should go see a therapist. And so I did, and I went and saw a therapist. And it was either the first or the second meeting after that. She started asking questions a little bit about how much I drank. And I always tell her, I was like, I think I lied and told her roughly half of what I drank. And she was like, yeah, you should go to AA. And like, but that was enough to kind of qualify me for even a half mark there. And I was incredibly offended by that because I grew up around a lot of alcoholics and I knew what they had gotten to. And I hadn't had the exact same experiences as them, even though in reality, looking back, some of the things I did were way worse than some of the things that they did, but it's because I didn't have this certain kind of experience that they did. I was using that as my crutch of why I could not be an alcoholic. No way. So I was really mad at that lady. And, but I wasn't court ordered. You know, I didn't have to go do this. But I had a level of desperation. Because I didn't want to be taking ecstasy anymore every weekend and being whacked out. And even though I didn't think that was the problem, I just knew that like something was wrong and I just thought maybe this would help. I don't know. So I went to my first meeting. It was a speaker meeting just like this and they had a lot of these in Ohio. And for the first couple of months, that's all I did is I only went to speaker meetings. I'd go to one a week and I'd sit all the way in the back. And the second the meeting was over, I'd dart out the door so I didn't have to talk to anybody. And I felt like I was working the program and like I was part of AA. But I also felt like, because I would occasionally attend, it was only a couple months later when I actually started going to more discussion meetings, but I always felt that this program seemed like it made sense and it was good for all the people that needed it, you know, you people. But I didn't think that I was you people and I didn't think that I needed this. But I can't explain why I kept going back. Like, why would I have, right? That doesn't really make sense. The only thing I can think about, and I don't remember this aha moment of it, but I guess I just probably looked around and just saw people that were happy and thought, if they're doing this, maybe I'll just kind of keep listening or maybe I'll, you know, there's got to be something here. These people didn't seem like they were faking that they were happy. And not to say that everybody was, but I mean, I caught the vibe for sure. And slowly but surely, I just started, you know, I got a sponsor and I started doing the steps and but I hadn't really dove into the whole second and third step thing. That G word, I was like, this is a bunch of bull. That's like a cult kind of a thing. I don't like religion was what I thought because I thought that this is a program based around religion, which is absolutely not. And so that's just kind of where my head was. And, I think I went through the second and third step, but I just kind of, like they said, fake it till you make it. I didn't really dive into it or put a lot of faith into that. And a little over a year and a half into my sobriety, another incident happened that was kind of moving. And I was just like, aha, I knew it. This whole God thing is BS. That program is BS. F these people. I'm going to go drink. And I was on my way to a meeting and I still remember where that gas station was at. And I went and bought alcohol and I was just like, game over. And I went and I remember thinking like, for years, I was like, oh, if I ever relapse, it's just going to be like hookers and cocaine. I'm just going to go out in this big blaze of glory. And what really happened was I drank like five beers that night and started crying on my couch. And again, Bud Lights, like because like that's what we drank in Ohio. And but I tried to get to the blacked out state and I couldn't do it. Like my stomach wouldn't absorb the alcohol that night. I couldn't drink it. And so basically, when I woke up the next day, I'm like, this is terrible. I'm like, if I drink, I'm miserable. And if I don't drink, I'm miserable. Because I like what always worked didn't work that night. Like I couldn't get to the blacked out state. And I would hear in these rooms for years, like, well, when the alcohol stopped working for me, and that didn't click with me. I didn't understand that for the longest time of like the alcohol not working because it always worked. because of getting to that blacked out state. So I just felt like, great, now what am I going to do? Like, nothing works. And so I just figured, like, well, I know if I'm going to be miserable regardless, I know that alcohol is bad for you, so I might as well at least be healthy. So I decided to stop, and I went back to the program literally the next day after that relapse. And from there, I took it extremely serious. You know, I think the first time I went through the steps, it took me a good solid 9 months to get through it. The second time was like a week. I blazed through it really hard. And like I called my sponsor and I was like, let's do this, because I knew the effect that it got from it. I wanted to hit it hard. I had actually had like what I would consider a spiritual experience the first time I did a fifth step. And I was seeking that again, even though it didn't happen again the second time that I did it. And I remember him being like, well, I'm about to go to Florida for a week. And I'm like, well, that's not going to work. Like, I got to get through the steps, you know. And he's like, well, I'm not changing my plans for you. And so he shipped me off to his sponsor. But, yeah, I got through it. And ever since then, I've always taken the program serious. And it's been 12 years. You know, I've had a lot of sponsees come and go. I've done the steps. I've done tons of service positions over the years at all these different meetings that I go to. I'm a GSR at my home group now, which is pretty cool. It's something I've never done before. I'm starting to get involved with a little bit of a deeper level and have a great love for that. I believe in a higher power and putting faith into that. And to, I guess, just to briefly talk about that. I was a hardcore God doesn't exist, and believing in something like that is, you're basically a simpleton. That's the way I looked at it when I came into this program. And having faith in something like that makes absolutely no sense. Like, that's where my brain was. And what I can tell you is that even though I fought that for a really long time, once I started, you know, kind of putting faith into like, well, maybe it's possible that that does make things better, my life has started to change from that. And I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that, like, I know that God or a higher power is working in my life. And I hear people say that. That's not my experience. Like, I don't know. So every day when I wake up, I do say prayers towards what I consider a higher power. And from time to time in the middle of a day, you know, we pause when things are kind of screwed up, and I'll do the same thing. I don't know if there's anyone or anything or whatever is absorbing or hearing, like, when I put prayer towards that. But what I can tell you is I feel like that I'm doing the right thing, and I have faith that I'm doing the right thing when I do that. And my life is continually, like, slowly just going uphill and uphill and uphill, and it keeps getting better. And I don't want to mess with that. And I don't want to sit and theorize, like, well, is that real or is it not? Blah, 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 blah. Like, I don't care if it's real. I don't care if there's a higher power, to be honest with you. Like, I feel like I'm doing the right thing, and I feel like that's working for me, and that it, like, I'm being taken care of, which is something I just recently talked with my sponsor, because I was struggling pretty heavily a few weeks ago about something. And what we kind of determined was, like, I was not really putting faith in that I was being taken care of, and I felt like everything was a panic. And once I really dialed back into that, like, I can actually kind of get through anything, I calmed down, like, instantly. And again, I don't even know if that's necessarily true, but it kind of seems like it. And that's good enough for me. Like, that's the desperation level that, like, I had when I first got into this program. Like, I'm desperate enough that I want to stay sober, that I'm not going to question all those things, and I'm not going to try to put, you know, a stamp on it of what's actually going on there. I don't care what's going on. I'm staying sober, you know? And I don't try to preach that of other people of what they should or shouldn't believe or whatever. I just try to show my sponsees, like, what I do to stay sober. I don't dictate my sponsee's life. I don't tell them, you will call me every day, or you will go to this amount of meetings, or you will do will, you're going to do this. I don't do any of that stuff. I tell my sponsee, like, this is what I did to stay sober. Here's the information. You can do with it what you want. It's up to you if you want to work it, and I'll be there if you call. And that's how I do it. And I mean, in a way, it's kind of like as a consultant. That's what I do for work, and I'm basically acting as that instead of managing his life. And I can tell you all that I never thought I'd be here. I didn't think I'd live this long. I didn't think I'd be 12 years sober. I didn't think I'd have the ability to cry. I cried my eyes out when Chris Cornell died the other day. I lost it. I really did. You know, I can't explain that. It's just because I'm sober, and like I feel like I'm really alive right now, and I have real emotions that I'm actually dialed into now, which they were basically just drowned over back in those days, and they were covered up with drugs and alcohol because I didn't have the tools to deal with life. And now I do have tools, and it's the tools from the program and, you know, the fellowship of the program and everybody in these rooms that have helped me over the years. Like I've gotten so much help here that I'll never be able to repay it all back. That's impossible from all the help I've gotten, but I can just keep trying. And I kind of feel like I'm just on this planet now just to help people. That's I feel like that's why I'm here. And that's my number one goal in life, is just to help people. That's it. Thanks.
Hey, I'm Nikki. I am definitely an alcoholic.
Hi.
When I did this last year, I was so nervous that I just didn't know what I wrote some notes, but it's not because I won't remember it as much as I tend to get a little off the subject because I'm an alcoholic. I'm a little crazy. So my home group is Daily Reprieve at Magnolia. I'm a rebel. I want two of them. And my sobriety date is March 25th, 2014. Wow. And I do have a sponsor. She's incredibly cool and silly and extremely patient with me. When she doesn't take any of my, I can't swear, BS. So that is the best, maybe the best part about her. So let's see. My story starts, I just turned 40 and I'm still having major issues with that number. I don't know why, but so it started 40 years ago. Right. And, I was raised in Bellevue. But it was not the Bellevue that you know today. It was like old school. We raised chickens on a farm. I mean, like Microsoft was in a strip mall. It was a very small place. And my parents both graduated from Mercer Island High School. And so that was kind of rebellious to like go to Bellevue, and they just didn't want anywhere near Mercer Island. So I understand that. And so my parents got married and settled. My mom is a normie and, was actually quite involved in Al-Anon and still is, because she had to be to stay sane with living with my dad. And my dad is an alcoholic and, comes from a very long line of alcoholics. I can remember being very scared of my dad. He was a loving man who loved me, and I knew that, but he was hard. He was rough around the edges. I was only six when he left, and I was old enough and that I understood why people didn't stay together if they couldn't. I got that. But he left to be with somebody else, and I don't know why I couldn't quite wrap my head around that. Either way, I think I was scared of men from a very early age. And and that's kind of where my story started. I went from living in like this farmhouse with like this dad who worked and my mom tended the farm to like my dad splitting. My mom had to go back to work at Safeway and work full time, and I was alone a lot. And and I was very anti-alcohol till I was about 17. Alcohol had just screwed up everything, and I hated it, and I couldn't say enough bad things about it. Until I got drunk for the first time, I was not anti-alcohol anymore. In fact, I was so relieved to have that feeling. You know, we hear a lot about people that just don't quite feel right in their skin, and, you know, they felt really awkward. Well, I actually, you know, I did okay. I wasn't like I did all right. You know, I had friends, and things were pretty good. But something didn't feel, I don't know. All I know is the first time I got drunk, I was like, okay, like now I can be this person. I had friends who were literally worried about me because I didn't drink, you know, like because I just wasn't a normal kid and, you know, take a load off. And that's what I did. I took a load off. It got pretty crazy after that. And I drank all through my senior year in high school and got into immediately consequences kicked in. I got messed up all over the place. And my mom, my poor mom, just didn't really know what to do with me. But I moved out and went to college at the U, and I was hell-bent on being this university student. My dad's like, you know, do you maybe want to try community college? I'll no, I made it to the U. I'm going to the U. And I did not know what – I didn't go to a terribly academic school in high school, so I really wasn't prepped. I mean, I was scared I was scared out of my mind. I just didn't – I didn't know what I was doing, you know, that first year. I just remember calling my mom and weeping. I have this paper due tomorrow, and I don't even know what it's on. And, I mean, I was just – it was so – like, I wasn't an adult. And suddenly I was, like, living with all these adults on my own, and that's nuts because I – my mom really put the reins on me kind of because she knew where I was headed, and suddenly I could do anything I wanted, which is really scary. But – I really started doing drugs that are legal now type of thing. I know we're really not supposed to talk about drugs, but I realized really early on that it was very impractical to drink and have an 8 o'clock class and try to drink and then wake up in time for an 8 o'clock class. It just wasn't really working for me. So I had a friend bring some things over and, I just completely switched addictions is what happened. And that pretty much went on till my second year in college. I was, so I was 19 and I was losing my mind and I got diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And I know people have mixed feelings about talking about mental illness, but for me, dual diagnosis is a really, well, it's a bum deal for one, but other than that, it's a large part of my story. I didn't understand why I could go all this time and be okay, and then suddenly I wasn't okay. And the truth was, I hadn't been okay for a long time. But I suddenly couldn't subsist without these meds, and really back then they thought you would take maybe some Prozac for a year and get through the tough times, and then, you know, you'd go on with your merry life. And I spent the first 10 years of the diagnosis trying to get off meds, which wasn't such a hot idea. It wasn't until I was about 30 and I went in for some electroconvulsive therapy that I had a very wise doctor who just said, the reality is you're probably never going to go off meds. And that didn't make me sad at all. I just wish someone would have told me that like 10 years earlier and I wouldn't feel like such a failure, you know? It made a lot of sense. You know, you can think of it. I love when people try to liken mental illness to, like, you know, high blood pressure and, you know, it's just like diabetes. You have to take insulin. Yeah, whatever. Diabetes doesn't have the stigma that mental illness does. So you're dealing with that, you know? When I was about 30, I had a boyfriend who went to prison for a year, and I pretty much got a bottle of wine on the way home from the first – from dropping him off there, and it never stopped. I still did my other drugs, but I needed that to slow down. And when he broke my heart, I, you know, ended up getting married at 31. I was divorced by 36. My ex-wife is a great person, and we've actually worked out a lot of our stuff, but she was very toxic for me, and we were just both very messed up, and two people that messed up together are just going to – it's messed up. And so that kind of went on. I probably knew from the first month of being married – that it wasn't going to last. But, you know, we milked it for like 5 years, which is ridiculous, but that's what happens in life. And she had been raised by an alcoholic and really hadn't drank a lot as an adult, and she didn't even know what to do with me, right? So the first thing she does is throws me in rehab. That lasts for about 9 months. We end up drinking together, and that went on for many, many years. I really struggled with hating myself for drinking. Drinking no longer felt even really good anymore. It just wasn't, it didn't, you know, to, the opposite was to not drink, and then I felt bad all the time. And I don't know. I just needed to numb myself. And, you know, drinking is a really crummy, it's a crummy coping mechanism, but the fact is it is a coping mechanism. And it worked for me for a while. And I think that if I hadn't drank, I probably would have maybe done something that was more permanent. So I guess it kept me from doing that. But when I was 37, I got pulled over, and I had definitely had a lot of, I had many, many things in my system, but as it turned out, I just got nailed for the drinking, and it was a really rough night, and I remember I blew up like a 0.4, and I passed all their sobriety tests, right? So I really thought I was like home free here. I mean, I thought I've passed the things. I mean, that's really what you need. Anyways, when they started to give me the breathalyzer, and that, you can't really fool that. I, you know, was fairly, I'm trying to, you know, blow into this thing. Like it was so ridiculous, but I mean, that's how crazy we are, right? So I said, well, I passed all those tests. What's the deal? And, you know, and the cop said, and the cop was a nice guy. He could have been a real dick, and he was nice. I don't know if that's swearing. it's just an anatomical part, right? Okay, so he said to me, he said, you blew a really high alcohol content, blood alcohol level. And I said, okay, well, he said, you know what that tells me? And I could think of all kinds of snotty things to say back to that. But what he said was, you've been doing this for a really long time. And everything went out of me. I just, I didn't cry. I just, it blew me away. And he looked at me and said, aren't you tired? And I thought, I'm really tired. I'm just exhausted. I can't do this anymore. And the state of Washington, I chose to go a deferred prosecution, so I had to get one of those fun little blown goes in the car, but they don't give you any of those consequences for about 2 months after it happens. So I, of course, continued to drink as much as I could since I wasn't going to be able to. And I remember that night drinking, my mom was sleeping in my room, and I got a couple big bottles of wine and I drank them, and I cried. And I said goodbye to alcohol, and it was so sad because I just didn't know how I was going to do without it. I knew it needed to happen. I even knew there were ways to do it, and there was support, and I knew that. It wasn't inconceivable to me. I just didn't want to do it. So my first year of AA was pretty rough. I got totally gypped on this pink cloud business. I think I was in the hospital 3 times in 9 months, and I really needed to get properly medicated, which I finally did, and it was night and day. I could work a program where I could remember. I remember my sponsor saying to me, okay, I'd read a paragraph or something, and she'd say, okay, so what did you just say? What did you just read? I'm like, I don't know. I mean, that's why this is so hard. It's because I don't know what I just couldn't retain anything. And those meds allowed me to have some self-esteem and to conceive what I was reading. And that was pretty awesome. I realized I needed to make some new friends because, you know, I had old friends that did forgive me, but I had some that didn't. And that was pretty hard to wrap my head around. So I think I got kind of a delayed pink cloud. It was joyous before it, you know, whatever. Anyways, what I essentially have learned in this program are that probably what any good therapist could tell you, but also a drunk could also tell you that we have tools. We really honestly don't have to drink over anything. And that sounded like complete hooey when I started. Aren't I more effective when I swear? But okay. But that was a pretty good thing to realize, and it doesn't mean I'm not going to have crap days. Man, I have crap days sometimes. So what I do know is that I start – I'm going to turn this off because I have a little bit of time left. I start every day with the daily reflection. I make a list of three gratitudes and three things I should need to pray about, and that's a pretty awesome thing. I continue to work my steps slowly but surely, and I know that I really only have to do one day at a time, like all these other annoyingly effective AA things. You know, I committed to it, and it worked. And the upshot is AA saved my life. I mean, I guess I could have killed somebody that night. I probably wouldn't have, but that's not the kind of life-saving I'm talking about. AA allowed me to have a life, and that's just really more than I could ask for. So, as my good friend always says, with that, I will take another 24.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.